that hymn, Blessed Assurance, was written by one of the most beloved hymnists of the church, a blind woman by the name of Fanny Crosby, Fanny J. And it was written, this particular one, in 1873. She was visiting a friend named Phoebe Knapp, K-N-A-P-P. And they were having a pipe organ installed in the Knapp home. And Mrs. Knapp played a little tune that she had been writing and she'd been working on. And she turned to Miss Fanny J and said, "What do you think that tune says?" And Fanny Crosby said, "Blessed Assurance, Jesus is mine." And then she soon wrote the lyrics, and Phoebe Knapp put the music to it, and the hymn first appeared in 1873. You have that because of my photographic memory, the photo that I saw on Google right before I came up here. We're getting ready in 2020 here to go into a pretty in-depth study of one of the most important books of the Bible. Now, when we say most important book, you have to be very careful because all of the Bible is inspired. I'll tell my students this, and since you're in some ways my students, all the Bible is equally inspired, but not all the Bible is equally inspiring. Does that make sense? Some of you will, and if you're not, I would encourage you to at least prayerfully consider it. Starting Wednesday, some of you are going to read through the Bible in 2020. You're going to hit Genesis, Exodus, boom, boom. You nail those. Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers. If you get past that, Joshua, the first half of Joshua, and this is, boys love these kind of stories. You got walls falling down, you got wars, and then at the end, the last half of Joshua, you've got the division of the land. And if you hear east and west one more time, you're about to scream. Then Judges is really exciting. You don't really understand why it's happening, but it's really exciting. Judges, Ruth, 1 and 2 Samuel, 1 and 2 Kings, 1 Chronicles. You hit the first 10 chapters of 1 Chronicles, and you're like, I don't care who begat who. Why in the world do we have, and if you do it, you know, line by line by line, you're like, it seems like it's taken me 6 days to get through 10 chapters. I will give you a little hint there. I listen as I read. And since I can read faster than Max McLean, can speak. And by the way, there was a generation that James Earl Jones was the voice of the Bible. Max McLean is the new voice of the Bible. But I can read faster than Max McLean can talk, so I have it on number two. I can keep up very easily with listening as I read. When I hit those begats, I'm around 2.5 to 3. There are letters that happen somewhere, and I'm identifying, yes, something happened there, but I'm just gonna, because it's not exhilarating, right? It's inspired, but it's not inspiring. You don't have that problem when you hit the book of Romans. Romans is one of those books of the Bible that is so inspiring. It is captivating. There are people that would say that if they were imprisoned and they could only take one book of the Bible with them for for their imprisonment, they would take Romans. It would be a great choice. Romans is, Romans to me is like Cliff Notes. Y'all ever had Cliff Notes? Some of y'all made it through high school with Cliff Notes. Some of y'all have never actually read a book. You just have read Cliff Notes. You don't even know how to spell Nathaniel Hawthorne or Charles Dickens because all you did was read the Cliff Notes. Romans is like Cliff Notes on the narrative of the Bible. Understand what I mean here. You'll hear me use phrases like the redemptive narrative. The redemptive narrative, by that, I'm talking about God's actions as he makes a promise with Abraham starting in Genesis chapter 12. Then as he forms Israel in order to make those promises come true, and as he deals with Israel, God's actions in those relationships told in those narratives, the stories all throughout. Those stories are not just illustrations for preachers to tell during the middle of a sermon. Those stories, that's what God's doing. And it culminates all through the Old Testament. It eventually culminates in Matthew tells it, Luke tells it. As Jesus comes, as Jesus lives a perfect life, he dies for us and is buried and is resurrected from the dead. Those are the historical events that happened. God was doing something. But in Romans, the Apostle Paul is the expert theologian commissioned by God as an apostle to the Gentiles and to all of us through his writing to tell us explain to us what God is doing. That's why I entitled the series Explaining the Gospel. Because what Paul is doing is we're reading Paul in Romans and we're seeing an authoritative explanation of what God was doing throughout the story that he did with creation, the fall, and Israel, and redemption. Guys, some of y'all are just kind of, let me put it this way. Look at this slide, this next slide. You know who that is? Guys, Paul is like the John Madden the biblical narrative. John Madden, you guys, and so the young guys are going, who's John Madden? John Madden was the greatest football analyst ever to be on television. Would have the graph. He would say, you know, what happened here is the tailback comes around and he hits this block, boom, and the running back goes through this hole, boom, and now you go, oh, that's why they ran that play. He explains the game to you. What Paul is doing, Romans is not the game. Romans is not redemption. Romans is the explanation of redemption. Romans is explaining to us what God was doing when if you realize that the apostles are standing there themselves on the day of crucifixion, just scratching their heads, wondering what's going on. We thought he was going like the defense in Madden. They thought he was going this way, and he goes this way. Paul now comes back in retrospect and with God's authoritative teaching tells us, here's what was going on the whole time. Here's why it was this way. And we get all of that packed into these 16 chapters of a book called Romans. That's why Romans is so important to us. We're going to introduce Romans in four phases. So today we're not going to be actually in the text of Romans so much. Next week we will start with the text, and I anticipate going through probably at least May or June with us. And if you're thinking, oh, my word, it's not going to be the eternal. I know of preachers that have taken 5, 10 years in Romans. I intend to finish this before my grandson can read. Okay. y'all are going, well, that could still be in 3 years. But the first phase of our introduction, I want to tell you the story of Paul. The story of Paul. Paul, to begin with, is this man who grows up in a very religious environment. As we introduce him, as we were introduced to him at first, he is an enemy of the gospel. There is a rumor of some men that are talking about Jesus. Well, Paul, or what we did not know him as Paul back then, he was known as Saul. Saul was birthed and brought up in a very Jewish home. And being fervently Jewish, he pursued a sect of Jewishness called the Pharisees. Pharisees were the most strict of the sects, of the groups that followed Judaism. You had others, the two primary ones. There are others as well, but the two primaries are the Pharisees and the Sadducees. The Pharisees were the fundamentalists. That they believed in Scripture, they believed in God, they believed in the resurrection, and they believed that it was all happening for Israel, because of Israel, because God loves Israel. Israel, they can't say Israel enough. And then you have the Sadducees. Now, you must realize that the Sadducees did not believe in supernatural events. They were the liberals. They did not believe in supernatural events. They did not believe in miracles. They did not believe in the resurrection. They did not believe in the resurrection. That is why they were sad, you see. By the way, that's like generations of Bible teachers telling that one. My kids are going, okay, Granddad told that one. When's he going to tell the next one? Well, Saul grows up in this environment with the Pharisees. He tells us that one of his instructors was a man by the name of, rabbi by the name of Gamaliel. Gamaliel was a very well-respected teacher. Saul buys into this hook, line, and sinker. He believes it. He lives it. And then he hears of this traveling blasphemer named Jesus, and he gets what's coming to him. He's crucified, and that takes care of that until some of Jesus' strange followers start talking like this man's been raised from the dead. Now, the Pharisees believe in the resurrection, but surely God resurrects righteous men, which would not be this Jesus character. And so Saul, gathering some groups around him, begins to protest against the way these Nazarenes, as they would have been called. One of the deacons, a man by the name of Stephen, is brought before the authorities. He says awful, blasphemous things in his defense of himself, and he is rightly executed, stoning. As the men of the town are gathering the stones and preparing themselves to execute Stephen, it is Saul's appointed job to watch over their stuff. he is approving. Perhaps in his mind wishing he could throw a stone. It's not enough for him to be a part of that. He then goes with some papers to arrest and torture some Christians that they know of down in Damascus. He gathers his men, he's on the way, and while he's on his way, he is struck with a light from heaven. And a voice from heaven, which is the voice of the Son, Jesus himself, says, "Saul, Saul, why are you persecuting my people?" No, it's not what he says. "Why are you persecuting me?" And then he adds one little barb at the end. He says, "It is hard for you to kick against the pricks." What's he talking about? I take that to mean that the Lord had been dealing with Saul in his heart, and Saul's resisting this. Has the Lord ever dealt with you about something and you fight it for a while? As if the Lord's telling him, the whole Jesus thing is real. Saul, no, no. Because remember how absurd this would have been for a Pharisee like Saul. For him to hear, no, Jesus really did rise from the dead. And Saul's saying, no, 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 no. He just doesn't want to hear it. And so he is confronted with the very person of Jesus. And the light that he experiences on the road to Damascus blinds him. God prepares one of the older Christians in Damascus, a man by the name of Ananias, to receive Saul. He says, "I'm sending Saul to you. I want you to take care of him and teach him, show him the way. I have many things I want to show him because he's going to suffer much for the sake of the name." And Ananias says, "Whoa, whoa, 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 whoa. Back up just a second. Did I hear the name Saul? Because isn't he the guy that is coming after us to arrest us?" And the Lord assures Ananias, "He's mine now." There's a power in the way the Lord says it, as if he's saying, "Don't worry about that. I got it taken care of." And Ananias goes up to Saul, first time he's ever laid eyes on the man, and he walks up to him and he says, "Brother Saul." What faith Ananias had to trust God that Saul, the one who was coming, perhaps with Ananias' name on the roll, to arrest and to persecute, for Ananias to trust God and to walk up to Saul and call him his brother. Saul is converted. He is shown by the Lord things that are going to happen to him. He then spends some time, we're not exactly sure how long, but he spends a good bit of time in the loneliness of the desert and the wilderness, being taught by God himself. He is then introduced to the apostles. They're a little bit wary of him. Maybe he's just pretending. But a man, I love Paul. Paul's one of the heroes of the New Testament. But if you're talking about the guy that I identify with most, I'm not Paul. But I want to be Barnabas. Barnabas, the apostles are worried about meeting with Saul. And Barnabas puts his arm around Saul, walks him in and says, "Hey, Saul, here's Peter, James, John. Well, James was not with them at that point, but here's John, here's Andrew. This is Saul. He's okay. I want to be Barnabas. Because I'm not going to be Saul, Paul. But maybe I should have named the whole series Better Call Paul. Those of you who are too holy to watch television don't get that. So he eventually will write 13 of the 27 books of the New Testament, at least 13. As to whether or not Hebrews is canonized as being written by Paul, but most scholars now do not think that he is the writer of Hebrews. I still hold out hope to that because I'm going to be honest with you, I'm a theologian. And the thought that there was a theologian of that caliber in the first century and we don't know who it is drives me insane. His name shifts to Paul as he begins to minister in predominantly Gentile areas. And because it's less Jewish, more Gentile, he becomes known more as Paul in those circles. After he's written and he's used by God, teamed up with Barnabas at first and then with Silas later, he goes throughout the Roman Empire, starting churches, preaching the gospel, arguing with unbelievers and Jewish people in order to show them that Jesus is the fulfillment of the promises that were made to them. He goes to the Areopagus in Athens and he argues with the Athenian philosophers. He tells them about Jesus and they have no problem with the crucifixion. The problem that they have is with the resurrection. Because of the way their Athenian philosophy was dialectic, and there was anything physical was considered in and of itself to be evil, and so they could not accept the idea that this person that God sent would resurrect, thereby taking once again the frailties of human flesh, because in their philosophy they don't see the physical world as being created by God good. Somewhere in the 60s, church tradition tells us that Paul as well as Peter were both executed at the hand of the emperor, probably Nero. Story of Paul. Second phase, the story of the church in Rome. The church in Rome is a product of the dispersion. The dispersion, somewhere in the late 40s, the Emperor Claudius kicks out all the Jewish people. There's a reference to this made in Acts chapter 18 when Paul meets Aquila and Priscilla. Y'all remember them? Love Aquila and Priscilla. And have often thought, I'm not going to name my son Aquila. Just Priscilla maybe for my daughters, but Aquila just didn't seem like a name I wanted. May her shallow hashbaz, good to go. Aquila and Priscilla, when they're introduced to us in Acts chapter 18, we're told that they've been expelled from Rome because of this edict from Claudius. The emperor's kicked out all the Jewish people. They're seen as troublemakers. He expels the Jews from Rome. About 5 years later, the Jews are allowed to come back. So what's happened is a church has apparently started in Rome. And as it starts, it's perhaps predominantly Jewish with a couple of those Gentile people that are allowed to come in. Then the Jews are sent out. When they come back 5 years later, the church is still going and it's still strong, and it's gone from a few of those Gentile people to a predominantly Gentile church. And now as the Jewish people come back in, there's this tension between the Jewish people and their understanding of the gospel and how Christians ought to follow the gospel, and the Gentiles and their understanding. Because the Jews, they're Jewish. Even following Christ, they're thinking about the Sabbath in the old Jewish way. They're thinking about the dietary laws in the old Jewish way. They're thinking about circumcision in the old Jewish way. The Gentiles, they love Jesus as much as the Jewish people do, but they don't have the Abrahamic context to come into. They don't have the context of the law. And so they're thinking of it very differently. But Paul sees the Roman church and realizes how important it is. And so he wants this division to be healed and for the Jews and the Gentiles to not be two separate churches, but to come together as one. And so it's very important to Paul to explain process of salvation, and I might call it the mechanics of salvation, because as you really, this is the closest thing we have to a systematic treatment of how God did salvation, how he accomplished salvation, what was going on behind the scenes. It's as if he pulls the curtain back and you see the what's going on in the nuts and the bolts of the salvation that he constructed for us. It's interesting that neither Paul nor Peter started the church in Rome. In fact, they hadn't visited the church in Rome. Paul and Peter will both eventually visit, but by the time Paul had written this, neither one of them had been there. You have the people from the different backgrounds. This is true throughout Paul's writings because he is so international. Intercultural, cross-cultural in his presentation of the gospel. You have it here in Romans, you have it with the Galatians, you have it with the Corinthians especially, where you have people, there are undoubtedly some of the people that had been not just not Jewish people, some of them had probably been worshiping a false god, a Roman deity, and then come to Christ. Perhaps I don't think this is far-fetched at all. I think it's very likely that you probably had some men and women who had been cult prostitutes for a pagan deity that then come into, that they learn of Christ and they come to Christ. And so you have people with that kind of baggage. And by the way, the baggage is never going to be, the scars of that baggage are never going to be gone. They're still going to be figuring out how to live this life of grace, this new way with the scars and the trappings of the old way. It's just that they have different old ways. Brothers and sisters, you need to know this about the church. We've all got baggage. We've all got scars. And we need to take one another's scars seriously. There's hurt, deep, deep hurt. And some people, their hurt is traumatically deep. But they are as loved and as part of the family as anyone. That is the message of grace. That is going to be what Paul focuses on in Romans. Now you'll see him in chapter 2, in chapters 9 and 10 and 11, talk about how the gospel relates to the people of Israel, to the Jews particularly. Because if they're going to understand the gospel, they've got to understand that God has not forsaken the promise that he made to Abraham. And so this entire cultural mess that is happening with the Jews is not secondary to the gospel. Paul wants them to understand what God is doing and that God has kept the promises, not he has not abandoned Israel. The thing that he's going to call it is the gospel, which means the good news. The good news is good news about God. Good news about God is that God, number one, has not forsaken his promise. Number two, God has come to us in our despair. I don't want to... Well, I'll say all three of these and then I'll tell you what I'm talking about here. Good news about God, good news about salvation. Good news is you don't have to accomplish it because bad news, you can't. And the good news about the future, that you become part of Him rather than the old. How is this gospel? How is it really good news? In the 1400s and 1500s, as there were monks everywhere, a German monk became an Augustinian, and he tried to live the order. He tried to follow everything that the law would require. He tried to go to his confessor, and he would confess for hours, literally hours. He would leave, and then, you know, 30 minutes later, remember some little peccadillo, small sin, I said that I did this, and I didn't do it for as long as I indicated that. And he goes and he confesses that, starts the whole thing over again. Maybe you've realized by now, I'm talking about Martin Luther. And his confessor at one point said, "Martin, either stop coming to the confessional or go do something worth confessing." Well, in the course of dealing with God and talking about God, within that context of earning salvation, a God who was just standing there waiting to judge every sin that you had committed. The monks once asked him, "Martin, don't you love God?" And he said, "Love him? Sometimes I hate him." Because all he felt from God was impending judgment. The gospel is saying, yes, he's the judge, but the judge is also the Redeemer. That's good news. It's like you're standing, my cousin, I'm hoping this is for me, and it's not Brian's vodka. My cousin, he's 27 days older than me. My cousin told me one time he was speeding along the freeway there in Florida, in Orlando area where he lived, and he sees the trooper's lights. He goes, "Ah! Dad's going to kill me." He pulls over. And he starts getting out his license. And he looks in the mirror as the trooper gets out. And it's his dad. Yeah, Dad was upset with that. But so it's like in seeing God through the gospel is that when you look up into the eyes of the judge, you find your Father. And that's good news. Third phase, and I got to go quickly here. the letter to the Romans, you'll see the need, the nature, the result, the challenge, the promise, the availability, and the transformation of the gospel. There's a flow, a logic to the to Romans, but the whole thing centers on the gospel, the good news of Jesus Christ. And then the fourth phase of this, he talks about the advantages of, or we want to talk about the advantages of studying Romans. This is important to us because Brian's class has been studying Romans for the last several weeks as well. And so you're like, oh my word, we're going to have to be in Romans forever. Kind of like the, you remember the Sandlot where it's forever. And you're like, oh, will we ever get out of Romans? Well, there are advantages to knowing Romans really well. Here are some of the advantages. It strengthens our understanding of salvation. I want it to strengthen our understanding of salvation because that's good for us as we approach the throne, to know what we have to be thankful for. Because when you know what God has done for us in salvation, saying thanks is not hard. The second part is strengthens our invitation to salvation. We got to work on that, folks. We had a few baptisms this year. If I were doing a New Year resolutions sermon, I want to challenge us toward 20 baptisms in 2020. I hadn't even thought about the 2020, but that'll work. We need to get marketing on that. 20 baptisms. You know why? Because we need to be sharing the gospel. And when we understand what God has done for us, how can you not tell somebody? So, folks, I want you to understand it so that you go to your neighbor, you go to your friend at work, you go to the person down the street, or you talk to the waitress at Cheddar's. Now, I go to Cheddar's a lot, so y'all need to go to some other places too. But go and get people, say, come on, because people need to know about this salvation. And it's so misrepresented by the world. As I've had our discussions with atheists and agnostics, their understanding of the gospel. One lady, she's a Buddhist professor of philosophy and women's studies at Vanderbilt, and she's studying to be a Buddhist priestess. And she was explaining why she rejected Christianity. And she said, I grew up in a Lutheran church. And in our catechism, they told us about the white dog that's on this shoulder and the black dog that's on this shoulder. And they're just fighting. And she's like, I just couldn't get into that. Well, no wonder you couldn't get into that. That's not the gospel. You can use an illustration about a black dog and a white dog and a demon on one shoulder and an angel on another. You can use those illustrations. That's not the gospel. You look long and hard in the New Testament. You know anything about black dogs and white dogs? Not going to find it. But if you know the gospel, inviting people to the gospel is really easy. It strengthens our appreciation for salvation, and as with my son-in-law and my daughter, they're the wonderful brothers at the Assemblies of God's churches, where I sometimes say, you guys, you don't spend enough time with doctrine, but the stuff that they understand, the stuff that they teach, man, they worship God and thank Him for it. And we seem very subdued. And when we see what God has done among Free Will Baptists, out in East Tennessee, people will start shouting. In fact, some of them will start running the aisles. Now, I'm not telling you what to do, but I am telling you to be excited about salvation. Strengthens our appreciation for salvation, and then it strengthens our transformation in salvation. Because there are some people who think, I'm saved, I got my ticket for the Glory Land Express, and I'm just going to get on the train and go. Okay, again, look long and hard in the New Testament, ain't no train. Okay? There's salvation, and salvation, the faith that produces salvation is a faith that produces a worshipful attitude of obedience toward God. You say, well, what if I sin? Well, of course you're going to sin. Don't say if. You're going to mess up because your view of God, your as much as you may want to obey him, we're going to get to chapter 7 where Paul says, the things that I don't want to do, I do, and the things that I want to do, I don't do. Ah! You got to read the Greek to know that part. Okay. Wretched man that I am. Who's going to deliver me from this kind of life? And by the way, there's a huge interpretive issue there where is he talking about himself prior to salvation, or is he talking to him about himself after salvation? And it can get there's argument from the text in either way, but it so fits what I feel. Now, you don't make interpretations out of what you feel, okay? It's like Ben Shapiro saying, facts don't care about your feelings, neither do interpretations. But it, as I look at, if Paul's talking about after salvation, I want to follow Jesus, but I just, I mess it up so many times. I know what that's like. But people that don't love Jesus don't kick themselves over it. I want us to be in love with Jesus, and we want to have the Holy Spirit transform us into his image. Those are the things I want us to accomplish, or I want him to accomplish in us as a people as we study Romans. As we come to the end of this, there's a lot for us to do in Romans. And Romans, by the way, is telling us about what God did. I challenge you to read this book many times in the coming months, to pour your heart out to the Lord for understanding and for your perspective on your salvation and your view of Jesus Christ to be clarified in the coming weeks.